to listen to the AA speak. It was beautiful, it was moving. I knew of the story, but when she gave it, I was moved to tears. I'm just hoping that her better half is not going to do the same for me while I'm facing you all. But then too, I thought, okay, that was the AA story. Tonight we get to hear the real story. So I won't say any more. I give you go.
Thank you, darling. Thank you.
Hi, I'm an island on from Hewittown, Alabama. My name's Bo Templin. Hi, y'all. So it's good to be up here and be a part of your party. I love parties and I love celebrations and I love these kind of things, I tell you. If we hadn't learned how to have fun in recovery, I just don't know if we'd be here. You know. And it's neat to be up here, you see, because this is our third trip to Jackson Mill, and we came up here one time when our sponsor spoke, and then we came into a thing in October, and we're back now for this, and you know, it was a time in our life that we didn't get invited back. and it's neat to know that we have at least reached that milestone in recovery where we can be invited back. And it's good to be able to get to be with some old friends, Billy and Marietta, that we've known for several years, and to get to spend some time with them and then get to make all these new friends. I'll tell you, this is great. We just really appreciate you inviting us and having us up here. And I appreciate you coming tonight to be in here with me, because you see, if I don't convince you of anything else tonight before we leave this room, I hope that I succeed in convincing you, each and every one of you, just how vital you are to me, just how important you are in my recovery. And I just thank you very much for being here, and by being here, becoming a part of my recovery. Because you see, as we go back home to Alabama tomorrow, I'm going to take some of each and every one of you with me. And I thank you for that. I thank you for sharing with me, you know, between meetings and at supper and at breakfast and being so kind and so open and giving me your love and your hugs. And you're now part of my recovery. And I welcome you to my life. And I thank you for that. I really do. I want to do a couple of things before I try to tell you a little bit about me. And the first thing that I want to do is I want to take just a minute and I want to talk to you. If you're sitting in this room with me tonight and you are a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to talk to just the sober members of AA for just a minute. And what I'd like to say to you, if you're sitting in this room with me and you are a sober member of AA, what I'd like to say to you is thank you. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think we as Al-Anons do that enough. And I want to do this from behind a podium in an open meeting. And I want to say thank you for a couple of reasons. Number one, I want to say thank you for being there 11 years ago when my gal reached out her hand. Because you see, I'd lost her. I didn't have her anymore. The booze had her, and I couldn't do anything about it. I was killing myself. I was driving myself crazy trying to get her back. And I couldn't do it. And when she reached the point in her life that she was ready to get sober, she reached out her hand to AA, and you had the hand of AA there. And you had the hand extended, and you didn't ask her any questions. You just said, come on in. And you took her in and you put your arms around her and you loved her and you taught her how to live sober. And as a result of that, we've been able to put that relationship back together. And this past April, we did celebrate 29 years of marriage and 5 years of dating. And that's 34 years we got tied up in this thing. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for that. But I also want to thank you for another reason. I want to thank you for knowing from the very beginning that this thing called alcoholism is a family disease. Now you see, I know that you knew it from the beginning because I've read your book. And I'm one of those Al-Anons that just doesn't make any bones about it. I believe in reading and studying the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, let me qualify that. I did not say put down your Al-Anon literature. Do not hear something I didn't say. That's not what I said. Because we got dynamite literature. What I said was find some extra time and get you a copy of the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous and read it and study it. You know, that's where our program came from. And I thank you for being wise enough for knowing that this thing is a family disease. You included two chapters in your book directed to us, the 8th and 9th chapters, to the wives and the family afterward. And then some 15 and a half, almost 16 years after you came into being, when it was time for Al-Anon to be born, and Al-Anon stepped forward and said, can we have your 12 steps too? You loved us enough, and you were kind and caring enough to say yes. You can have our 12 steps too. And you can learn to live a way of life where you can be happy, joyous, and free, and then not be dependent on what another person does or does not do. And for that, I say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do, and I hope you join me in the future and tell them. You know, one of our co-founders, Lois, said in some of her later writings, she said, AA did all the work. We just came along and reaped the benefits. Yeah, that's Lois's words. And I thank you for being here with us in our party this weekend, and I thank you for everything that you've given us over the years. When I introduced myself to you, I introduced myself as being from Hueytown, Alabama, and I am. But my home group is in Bessemer, Alabama. Now that's a distance of about 5 miles. There is a group in Hueytown, Alabama. And both of those groups lay claims on me. The Hueytown group claims I belong to Bessemer. And sometimes my home group claims I belong to Hueytown. It just depends on what tangent I'm off on at that time. But I do have a home group, and it is in Bessemer, Alabama. I introduce myself not only as being from Hueytown, I introduce myself as being an Al-Anon. And I'd like to talk about that for just a minute. Because you see, when I first got here, I thought being married to my real live alcoholic made me an Al-Anon. And what I've learned over the past almost 11 years is that being married to my real live alcoholic qualifies me for Al-Anon. It does not make me an Al-Anon. And I know a lot of folks that are running around out there today saying, I'm an Al-Anon, and they never darken the doors. And I want to say this for the benefit of the newcomers, because I'm fixing to tell you three or four things that I think is necessary for me to be able to stand up here and tell you that I'm an Al-Anon. And this is Bo's opinion, what's necessary for Bo. But it's the very things that I didn't do the first 7 months that I was around this program, before I got in it. And it's the things that I didn't do. And I share these things with you in the hopes that if you're new here, it might save you some of the time and the pain that I had to go through in that 7 months. And one of the first things that I'd tell you that I have to do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I've got to show up at some meetings. Yeah, I got to suit up and I got to show up and I got to occupy that chair. Now that ain't all of it, but it's a part of it. I got a buddy up in Cleveland that explains it this way. Some of y'all have heard him, a guy named Milt. Milt explains it this way. He says, Bo, I can go out my back door every morning, and as I go across the back porch, I can pick up that chair, and I can go to the back of the lot, and I can set that chair down in the middle of the chicken coop. And I can do that every day for 20 years, and I can sit out there, and I can occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop for 20 years. And guess what? I ain't never going to be a chicken. Yeah. So occupying the chair is not all of it. But let me tell you what will happen. If you occupy that chair every day in the middle of that chicken coop for 20 years, at the end of 20 years, you're going to know a whole lot about how chickens act. Yeah. And you're going to know a whole lot about how the ones that are successful at being chickens get that way. And you see, that's the deal about occupying this chair in this Al-Anon meeting. I'm going to see you winners. And I'm going to be exposed to you winners. And I'm going to see what it takes to be a winner in Al-Anon. So occupying the chair is a big part of it. The next thing I got to do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I got to have a home group. Now, that wasn't important to me when I first got here. It is important today. And you see, when I first got here, they had told my wife in this treatment center that she went to that she had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And we did. We did. You understand? But you see, I wasn't coming to Al-Anon for me. There was nothing wrong with me. You see, I got here well, and it took me 7 months to find out just how sick I was. And so I didn't need your home group, okay? But I was going to a lot of meetings because I was going to make sure she was there. Yeah. And we were going to a lot of meetings over here and over yonder and over there and circling around and making meetings all over the Birmingham area. And what was happening, of course, was Bo wasn't lighting long enough to make any roots. And he wasn't allowing anybody inside Bo. And he wasn't letting anybody know about Bo. And as a result, I wasn't experiencing any kind of spiritual growth. You see, and it wasn't until I got that home group in Bessemer and settled down there and began to do some other things that I began to experience some spiritual growth. But it started with the fact that I settled down and got me a home group. Now, I want to tell you AAs that are in here that are something that's probably going to surprise you. But us Al-Anons have egos too. Yeah. And it's there in my home group in Bessemer, Alabama, that my ego is taken care of. Because you see, God's done so many things that have been so great for me. And one of the first things he did was he directed me to that group in Bessemer, Alabama. You see, my home group is 32 years old, I'm sorry. We just celebrated our 32nd birthday. And so that means it's been around a while. But let me tell you what else. We still got some gals that show up there every Thursday night on a regular basis that were there when it started 32 years ago. Yeah. As a matter of fact, our speaker at our Al-Anon birthday party this year was the gal that founded our club 32 years ago. And some of these gals, their husbands have been dead for years. But they still are showing up at Al-Anon. And you see, I need those gals. Because I need those long-timers, those old-timers. Because it's folks like me that come in here that's got all these radical attitudes. And I'm going to change it all. And if you old-timers don't keep coming, we don't get the direction that we need. And God sent me to a group that was full of direction, full of good old-time Al-Anon. Old-time Al-Anon. And my home group is just absolutely very important to me. But it's becoming more important today for another reason. And I want to share that with you. You see, I've been around Al-Anon and in Al-Anon almost 11 years. My serenity date is September the 4th, 1982. And it's been almost 11 years. And I've been in this program long enough now that some of the rewards have begun to come to both. Some of the good things have begun to happen to me. And what I've learned is that as these rewards begin to come to me, along with them comes something called a responsibility. And you see, it's there in my home group in Bessemer, Alabama, that I fulfill my responsibility to Al-Anon. It's there in my home group in Bessemer, Alabama, that I show up on a regular basis. And I'm there when we have the group conscience. And I'm there when we elect the officers. And I'm there when we elect the GR. And I'm there when we handle the problems and make sure that our group stays within the traditions. So that 11 years from now, Al-Anon will still be there, as strong as it was 11 years ago when I came. And that's a responsibility that we all have today. And we need to begin to take a look at it and make sure that we're there. I make sure that that door is open. I make sure that the coffee is made. And I make sure the literature is out. And I make sure that the hand of Al-Anon is extended to the newcomer that's coming today in the same pure form that it was extended to me 11 years ago when I came. So if you hadn't got a home group, think about what I've said. Think about it. The next thing I'd share with you that I have to do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I've got to have a sponsor. Now remember, this is just my opinion. This is Bo's story. But I think that sponsorship is one of the most talked about and least utilized things in our fellowship today. I really do. And I was so proud when I saw the program and saw that there was a workshop here today on sponsorship. Yeah. Folks, get out and travel around. It ain't that way everywhere I go. It's just not that way. You know, I got a sponsor, and I know my sponsor's telephone number. I don't have to look in my billfold to get it. But I'm going to tell you something else. I got one of those old-time sponsors. My sponsor came into Al-Anon in 1961. My sponsor knows my telephone number. Yeah, exactly. And when Bo don't show up, or she hears something about what's going on with Bo, she'll pick up that phone and she'll call me. You bet. Now, if you're new here and you don't know a whole lot about sponsorship, there's a lot of people here that do. And if you'll see one of us when this thing is over, we'll talk to you and explain sponsorship to you. If you've been around a while and you don't understand sponsorship, shame on you. Shame on you. It's just your own fault because it's available. It's available. Don't try to do this thing by yourself. Get a sponsor. And I'll talk a little bit more about my sponsor as we go along tonight. But the last thing that I'd share with you that I have to do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I got to take those 12 simple steps. 12 simple steps for a very complicated person. And to the very best of my ability, I got to incorporate them in my life on a daily basis. Getting up every morning, talking with God, suiting up, showing up, putting one foot in front of the other, being the best Bo that I can be today. Sometimes I do pretty good with that. Sometimes when we're at these things and I'm around you, it's pretty easy to do that. You know? And sometimes I just don't do so good with it. But what I'm beginning to understand is, it's not whether I do good or I don't do good. That's not what's important. What's important is that I'm getting up every day and I'm putting forth the effort. Putting forth the effort. And these are some of the things that I didn't find it necessary to do for 7 months when I was around this program. The first 7 months I was here, I sponsored myself. And I don't recommend that to anybody. I just don't. So I just offer them to you for your consideration. Some of the things that you might think about that might save you some time and some trouble as you start this journey called recovery. But I guess I better, as I look at the clock up there, I better start telling you a little bit about me. And in order to do that, I have to go back and I have to start with this very simple statement. I was born at a very early age. And I have to go back and start it there, you see, because I was born into what I've come to believe is a real good breeding ground for AA, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen. I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. And I was taken to church Sunday mornings and Sunday nights and on Wednesday nights. And what's important about this is that it was there in that Southern Baptist church in Hueytown, Alabama, that I formed a conception of God that I was going to bring into adulthood with me that was going to cause me some problems. Now, I know it's not the church's fault, because I know that back there in that church, they talked to me about God being loving and God being forgiving. But you know what I brought into adulthood with me? God will get you. God will get you. And I had God sitting up there in that great white throne, and he had that big scoreboard up there, and it had Bo's name on it. And God was keeping tabs. And when Bo did something good, there was a little check, and when Bo did something bad, there was a big check. And every time the big check went up there, there was a price to be paid. And you see, several years down the road, when the disease of alcoholism reared its ugly head in our home, and things got as bad as they had to get, I looked on Shirley's drinking as a punishment to me for something that I had done. And you see, I never stopped praying, but my prayers became why me prayers. How could you do this to me, God? And what's going to happen next, God? And what can I do to straighten it out, God? And you know that I wasn't getting any answers to those kind of prayers. But it all started, you see, there in that Southern Baptist church. Now, my mom and my dad didn't drink. There wasn't any drinking in my immediate family. Alcoholism is rampant in my family tree. Shirley mentioned in her talk this morning, Aunt Katie. Aunt Katie, this past Valentine's Day, picked up a 31-year chip in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Uncle James, her husband, if he hadn't have died last July, well, it's been a year ago now, and Uncle James died, he was working on a 30-year chip when he died sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Got another uncle out there. It's got, should be coming up on about 10 years sobriety now. Got a younger brother that just got in April, picked up his 4-year chip in Alcoholics Anonymous. Got an uncle and a couple of cousins out there that are still working on their story. Sure are. But I was never subjected to any of this, you see. It just wasn't allowed around our home, and I was never subjected to any of it. And as a result of that, God gave me just a little bit of sports ability, and I was active in sports in school, and I didn't drink. Just never around it and never subjected to it, and I didn't drink. I met Shirley in my mid-teens, and we started dating. You heard her story this morning. You know that she didn't drink for totally different reasons. She comes from that broken alcoholic home. But the deal is, she didn't drink. And I met her, and I didn't drink, and she didn't drink, and we dated for 5 years, and we didn't drink. Drinking just was not a part of our relationship. And after about 5 years, we finally decided we was going to be able to get along. And we started talking about getting married. And here we were, just two kids, madly in love, ready to get married and set out on this great American dream. And we did. We did. Now let me tell you about this great American dream, what it consisted of. Our great American dream centered around something called a dollar bill. You see, we didn't know anything about life. We didn't know anything about having a purpose in life. What we had been taught was, successful people have lots of stuff. And we wanted to be successful, and we wanted to have a lot of stuff. Yeah. And so this was our great American dream. We were both going to have good jobs. We were going to work hard. And we were going to buy nice stuff and impress you. And of course, the fallacy is that if you lived up the street from me, when I bought something nice 2 weeks later, you had something a little nicer. So that meant we had to go get another job, get a raise, work harder, go deeper in debt, and buy something a little nicer. And it was all based on stuff. And that's what the great American dream was. And let me tell you, we got married, and she had a good job, and I had a pretty good job, and we became pretty good at accumulating stuff. Yeah. It wasn't but a year. We had enough money saved up, and we made that down payment on that first little home out there in Uetown. And we was on the way. Boy, things was working. And then 3.5 years after we was married, God gave us the most beautiful blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want. And Mike became a part of the great American dream. 17 months later, along comes Sissy, the most beautiful brown-eyed baby girl, all 10 fingers and all 10 toes, and just as healthy as she could be. And Sissy became a part of the great American dream. And we sat down and we took stock. And here we were. We had 2 kids. We had 2 cars. We had 2 jobs. And we had a home. And everything we had was mortgaged to the hilt. And we was happy. living the great American dream. Yeah. But you see, the great American dream had to have those two paychecks. So Shirley went back to work. And when she went back to work, after both of our kids were born, she was asked to join this social sorority, and she did. And it was at one of these social sorority dances down there on the Warrior River, not too far from our home. And it was a Saturday night, and it was late summer. And the lights were down low, and the music was soft, and the moon was ricocheting off the water down the river. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful place. And the kids at home tucked safely in bed with a babysitter. And I handed my wife the first drink of alcohol that she was to ever have. And I said, "Here, drink this." And it wasn't but just a few years till she was right up in my face. And she was telling me, "Bo, if you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today." Well, you see, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And what I did was I stopped and I took stock, and I could see that our lives had changed. And that it had changed for the worse. And that things had started going downhill, and it started the night I gave her that drink. And so you see, I accepted that guilt. And I agreed with her. And I absolved her of any responsibility for anything that happened as a result of drinking. Because you see, I had given her that first drink. And that was a load of guilt that was almost to break my back before I got to you people in Al-Anon. It just almost got more than I could bear. Now, I could stand up here for an hour or so and share war stories with you, and that's fun. I like war stories. You know what war stories are. War stories is when Gary tells me about he cut his finger, had to put a Band-Aid on it, and I tell him, "Oh, that's nothing. Jeez, I cut my finger and had to have 32 stitches, you know." And then Billy speaks up and says, "Oh, guys, that's nothing. I cut mine off, and it grew back." You know, that's what war stories are. I tell you one, and it's a one-up deal. And I love war stories. They're a lot of fun. But rather than tell you war stories, what I'd like to do is I'd like to stand up here and talk to you about something else for a minute, because I found out something about war stories over the last 11 years. I found out that my war stories and your war stories are the same. All the times are different. The places are different. You know, the situation maybe is a little different, but what's the same is the pain. We all hurt alike. And rather than talk about war stories, I'd like to talk to you about some of the pain that I experienced as a result of the disease of alcoholism in our family. And of course, the first pain I'd share with you is that pain of guilt that I've already told you about, that was to do nothing but get heavier and heavier and heavier until I got to you people. The next pain that I'd share with you is a pain called anger. Now, I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. And on a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And I was living my life that way. And toward the end of Shirley's drinking, if you had set me down and I had gotten honest with you, I probably could not have told you who or what I was angry at or about. I just knew I was angry. And then I'd like to talk to you and share with you a little bit about that pain of resentment. And I really didn't know what resentments were till I got here, but I found out I had them. I knew that I didn't like you if you lived up the street from me and you had something nicer than me. I knew that I didn't like you if you lived up the street from me and I saw you and your family getting in the car and doing things together. I knew I didn't like you if I ran into you at the mall and you were genuinely happy and you had a smile and I knew that you meant it. I knew I didn't like you if you worked at the bank and you wouldn't honor our check just because there wasn't any money in the bank. Yeah. And I knew that I was just ate up with these I don't likes, I don't likes, I don't likes. and I was angry and I was full of resentment, and this is the way I was living my life. And yet, if you walked up to me, I had that smile that all Al-Anons have. We all have it. That fixed smile when I'm fixing to lay one on you. And usually the one I laid on you was, "Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine, thank you." And this is the way I was living my life. I would like to talk to you for a minute about a pain that I hear alcoholics talking about. I hear them talking about the loneliness and the isolation of their disease. And I do believe you. I know that alcoholism is a disease of loneliness and isolation. But what I want you to know is you don't got a corner on the market. I know about loneliness and isolation too. And it doesn't have anything to do with how many people are in the room. Some of the loneliest times of my life have been in crowded rooms surrounded by people that were really, really dear friends of mine. And I'll explain it to you this way. Shirley, as she told you, was a kitchen drinker. Now, she got off work at 4 o'clock every day, and she was home at 4:30. And at 4:31, she had a drink in her hand. And she would drink until she passed out, and this was pretty much a daily thing. Now, I didn't get off work till 5 o'clock. So you know what I had to do every day at 4:45? Yeah, I had to call. Because you see, I can smell it over the telephone. Yeah, you're nodding your head. Some of you know what I'm talking about. And if she had started drinking, what was usually the case is that I didn't go home then. Because you see, if I went home, I was face to face with that other pain that almost got me. I was face to face with my failure. And you see, if I didn't go home, I didn't have to face my failure. And here I was the husband, and I was the father, and I was the head of the household, and I was supposed to be able to fix anything. And I couldn't fix her. She was my failure. And I couldn't go home because I was face to face with her, and I just couldn't handle that. What's so crazy about this is that I was very, very successful in every other area of my life. I was at the top of my profession. Could not go any further without owning my own automobile dealership. I was making good money. I was playing fast pitch softball on a semi-pro basis, and we had a sponsor that was flying us all over the southeastern United States on weekend. And we were good, and we won, and we were successful. I was successful in my job. I was successful in my recreation. But you know what I walked around feeling like all the time? A failure. Because I couldn't sober my wife up. I couldn't sober up. And if I went home, I was face to face with it. So you see, I didn't go home. I went up the street to the local water hole with the guys from work. Let me tell you a little bit about our water hole. Had a big long bar, and at the end of that bar had a big round table. And that's where all the guys from where I worked gathered every afternoon. About 8 guys sit around that table. Something strange happened at that table. I didn't understand it then, don't understand it now. But this is the way it was. When you sat at that table, you did not just buy your drinks. Everybody that came in and sat down at the table bought a round. And then if somebody finished a drink, they ordered a round. Well, you see, what was happening was I was sitting there at that table, and people were ordering rounds of drinks, and there was 3 and 4 and 5 drinks lining up in front of me. And I'd look at them, and I'd thought would go through my mind, "Why are you here, Bo? You ain't going to drink them. I might drink one, I might drink 2. And the ice was going to melt in the rest of them. And I'm sitting there, and the tapes are playing, and it's going like this. Why are you here? And I'd look around the table, and I'd know that it wasn't a war story. See, they tell war stories up there, too. But I'd heard them all, you see. I'd heard all the jokes. I knew the punchline. As soon as somebody got ready to tell a joke, I knew. And then the thought would come, you're here because you can't go home. That's the reason you're here, because you can't go home. And then, of course, the thought would come, why don't you tell these guys why you can't go home? These are your best friends. These are the guys you work with every day, and you play golf with them on the weekends. These are your good friends. Why don't you tell them? Maybe they could give you an answer. Maybe they could tell you something to try. And, of course, immediately the red flag went up. No, dummy. You can't tell them. You see, I was the only man on the face of the earth who had a drunk wife at home. And I couldn't tell you. And so I sat there in a crowded place, surrounded by friends. And I stuffed it. And I was lonely. And I was isolated. I know about loneliness and isolation. I really do. This disease made me the most proficient liar in Jefferson County, Alabama. And I wasn't raised to be a liar. I was raised in that church. And I was taught the difference between right and wrong. And I was taught the difference between a truth and a lie. But you see, the disease of alcoholism gave me two new tools to use that made it okay for me to lie. And those two buddies of mine are called rationalization and justification. Because you see, I could rationalize and justify anything. And it made it okay to lie. And the greatest example of this is me and the gal down at Alabama Power Company. That's the utility company in our area. Probably nobody else in here had this problem. But we had a problem keeping the power turned on at our house. And we'd gotten to the point where we could skip one bill, but when the second one came due, it had to be paid. There was no grace period. Well, I mean, we'd done used all that up. And this lady down there at the Alabama Power Company, we'd gotten on a first-name basis. She'd call up there to the dealership, and she wouldn't ask for Mr. Templin. She'd say, "Let me talk to Bo." And she'd get me on the phone, and she'd say, "Bo, your power bill hadn't been paid again." And she said, "If it's not paid by 3 o'clock this afternoon, we're going to have to turn your power off." And I'd kick in. And you know the first thing that would kick in? Was that smile. Remember that smile I told you about? I'm talking to her on the phone. But the smile comes because I'm thinking to lay one on her. And you know, it would go something like this. "You know, it's funny you should call me today. Shirley just told me last night she hadn't paid the power bill again. I didn't know it until last night. And I stopped on the way to work this morning and I dropped you a check in the mail." Check's in the mail. Well, of course, that was a lie. Because, you see, Shirley hadn't told me. And the other deal was it wouldn't have done any good to mail a check. That meant there wasn't any money in the account anyhow. But this gave me till 8 o'clock the next morning. Because, see, she wouldn't turn the power off. She'd wait on the mail to come. And I had 8 o'clock the next morning to go to Mother or to go to Uncle or to go to somebody and be down there with the cash money, pay that bill when the office opened up, and keep the power from being turned off. Now, it was okay to do that, you see, because of the kids. The kids had lessons to get. They had baths to take. They had, supper had to be fixed. It was taking care of the kids. And that made it okay to tell this lie. And I had no qualms at all about doing that. After I'd been in this program long enough to finally get me a sponsor, and I've already told you, I got me one of those old-time sponsors. And old-time sponsors, they zing you. You know, every once in a while, they just zing you. And we were sitting there talking one day, and Fran just zinged me. She said, "Let's talk about honesty." And I said, "Oh, no." no. And I told her this story because it had been on my mind about how I had told this lie for years, you know. And I told Fran the whole story. And I told her, I said, "But it was okay to do that because, you know, I had to take care of the kids. Couldn't let the kids hurt." And Fran looked at me and she said, "Bo, was there ever a time that you couldn't get the money?" I said, "Oh, yeah, several times." And she said, "Well, what'd they do?" I said, "They turned the power off." And she said, "Well, what'd you do?" I said, "We did what any great American family living the great American dream would do. We pulled out that plastic card, that money that you ain't got, and we told the kids to pack an overnight bag. We was going to take them down to the Holiday Inn for a day or two. And we was going to go on a little vacation and let them swim. And of course, what we did is we stayed there till I could get the money and get the power turned back on." So Fran looked at me and said, "Well, then, really and truly, the kids never did hurt then, did they?" I said, "No, they didn't." And she said, "Why do you think you had to tell that lie, Bo?" Let me tell you why I had to tell that lie. And I hope this has never happened to you. But in Hueytown, Alabama, when they turn your power off, they have a big red tag. It's about this wide. And it's about this long. And it's bright red. And it says on that tag, "We have turned your power off." because you ain't paid your bill. And when you bring us, and it's got a big blank space where they can put a lot of numbers in there, when you bring us this much money, we'll turn your power back on. And they hang it on your front doorknob. And see, that was the deal. I couldn't allow that to happen. Because if you lived up the street from me, if you lived around the corner from me, and you passed by my house and you saw that, then you would know. And I couldn't let you know. Because see, we had the curtains pulled out there on 28th Avenue in Hewittown. And we didn't let you in. It was total chaos inside those walls. It was four individuals living four separate lives under one roof. But we had that one unwritten rule that every alcoholic home has. That unwritten rule that says we don't talk about it. And you see, our deal was, when you got ready to leave, right before you hit that front door, you stopped and you straightened up. And you put that smile on. And when you hit the front yard, you told the world we were fine. And that's the reason I had to tell that lie. It was because I could not let you know what was going on in our home. And that's a sad, sad way to have to live. This aunt that I've got that's got 31 years sobriety, she called me at work one day and she said, "Bo, how's it going out there? How's it going out at the house?" And you know the first thing that happened? That smile. I'm finna lay one on her. And I said, "Oh, Aunt Katie, things are fine." She said, "No, they ain't." She said, "We've been watching." She said, "It's not fine." She said, "I want to know how are you and the kids doing?" And I said, "Aunt Katie, we're doing better. We've come up with something that seems to be working." And she said, "What's that, honey? Tell me about it." And I said, "Well, you know, every night after Shirley passes out and we get her in bed, I said, the kids and I go on a witch hunt." And I said, we know where all her hiding places are. I said, "She cannot hide booze from us anymore. We found them all." And I said, "When she passes out, we go on our witch hunt and we find all her booze." And I said, "I pour it out and I throw the bottles away." And Aunt Katie just laughed and she said, "I didn't know you were that well off financially." And I didn't understand. And I asked her to explain. And she said, "Well, what does Shirley do the next day on the way home from work?" And I said, "Well, she stops and buys more." She said, "Bo, you're pouring dollars down the drain." I said, "It ain't going to help. So quit doing that." And I told Aunt Katie, I said, "I appreciate you telling me that. And I promised her I'd change." Now, this was 2.5 years before my wife went into treatment. And I did change, but I got to be honest with you. I didn't quit pouring that booze out. I poured that gal's booze out till the day she went into treatment. I used to feel bad about that, worry about how much money, but I don't worry about that anymore. I know it was something I had to do. It was just something I had to do. But here's what I changed. Every night then, from then on, me and the kids would go on that witch hunt, and we'd find that booze, and I'd pour it out, but I didn't throw the bottles away. I set them empties up on the drain board. Yeah. And had them lined up for her when she got up the next morning and walked in the kitchen. Because, see, I was sending a message to her. "See, we found your booze, and we poured it out." And I'll tell you something about where communication was in our home. We were just passing and repassing and sending messages. It was about all we could do. And I did that for 2.5 years, and Shirley was in that treatment center, and I was up there one day, and we kind of got, I don't know how the conversation got around to it, but I told this story. And when I told this story, Shirley's jaw dropped wide open. She said, "My God, Bo," she said, "for the last 2 years I've walked in the kitchen, saw those empties and said, 'You dummy, you blacked out and drank it all again.'" She never knew. She never knew. I continued to do everything that I knew to do to get my gal sober, and I couldn't do it. And our family was just like your family. As long as the drinking was there, things went downhill and things got worse. He looked at his mom, and he was 15 years old at that time, and he looked at his mom and he said, "Mom, when we get home tonight, you're going to be passed out on the couch or passed out on the floor."
and he didn't wait for an answer. And you see, we never know what it's going to be that's going to trigger him. We just never know. And you see, for the first time in her life, Shirley wanted to lay a hand on her son, and she knew that it had something to do with drinking. And Mike didn't wait for an answer. He just got in the car, and we went to the ball game. And when we got home that night and we pulled in the driveway, we knew that something was different. Because, you see, she wasn't passed out. And it was well past her passing out time. And the front door was open, and we got out and we went in, and she met us at the door, and she wasn't drunk. She had been drinking, but she wasn't drunk. And she told us that she had called a treatment center and that she was going to do something about her drinking. And I looked at her and I told her, I said, "Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's different this time?" And I told her I didn't believe her. And I went to bed. And it was the next day at work when this treatment center called me for some insurance information that I realized that she had called. It was only then that I believed her. Now let me tell you, God was taking care of us then. He was in total control of our lives and directing our lives at that point, and we didn't even realize it. Because you see, God directed us to a treatment center that believes wholeheartedly in treating the disease of alcoholism as a family disease. And he sent us to a place that believes wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And there were some treatment centers in our area that didn't do it that way at that time, and we didn't know the difference. And I know today that God knew, and his plan was for us to end up in AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And he just sent us there for just a little brief period to get us ready to come to you people. Is exactly what was going on. I didn't know that at the time. You should have seen us that Thursday morning as we left to take Mama to treatment. I had a pickup truck, and the kids put two lawn chairs in the back of the pickup. And they were back there, and they had a cooler full of Pepsi. And they had their blaster radio. And me and Mama's up front, and off to treatment we go. Fully intending to take her up there and drop her off and leave her for 28 days and come back and get her. And she would be fixed. And then we could get on about the great American dream. And we got up there and we got her checked in, and this counselor says, "I want to talk to you before you leave here." And he said, when he talked to me, he said, "We have something up here called Family Week." He said, "It's going to happen in a couple of weeks, depending on her progress." And he said, "What it is, we want you and both kids," because they were 15 and 13. "So we want you to come up here, and we want you to spend 5 days up here and be a part of the treatment process." And he said, "But I'm not going to go into a lot of detail." He said, "I'll send you a letter that will explain it." And he excused us, and we left. And as we got in the truck and we're on the way back home and the kids are up front with me, the kids told me, said, "Dad, we don't know about this thing called Family Week." They said, "We scoped that place out up there, Dad. They don't have a swimming pool." I said, "Dad, they don't even have Coca-Cola machines. All they got's fruit juice. And Dad, there's no game room. Daddy, they don't even have TVs in the rooms." So we don't know about that, going up there and staying for 5 days. And I said, "Kids, settle down. We're not going up there. I was just being nice to that guy. That's his job." I said, "There's nothing wrong with us. We're not going." And we went home. About a week later, the letter comes in the mail, and I open up the letter and I read it, and there's a statement on the page that just literally jumps off the page at me. And the statement said, "We want you to come up here and stay for 5 days and learn how to live with your alcoholic." Now that made sense. And I called the kids in. And I sat them down and I showed them the letter and I showed them that statement. And I said, "I've been thinking about this, kids. I said, you know, there's certain things that your mom can't do anymore. There's certain foods that she can't eat anymore. There's certain, you know, certain things that she don't need to drink anymore besides alcohol. I think we better go up there. Because what they're going to do in this 5-day period, kids, is they're going to teach us how to keep your mom sober." And the kids and I sat there and talked about it, and it was going to happen in the month of August, so they were out of school for summer vacation. We had darn good insurance. Remember, this was 11 years ago. We had darn good insurance that was going to pay for it all. Yeah. I was not like any good untreated Al-Anon. I had 6 years of unused vacation time. So there was no reason to not go. And we went to Family Week. Now, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on Family Week, but I do want to tell you two or three things. We had not been on the property 30 minutes till I was in a standing up shouting argument with a counselor. We got there and we walked in and they sent us down to this wing. There was going to be 18 of us people up there representing 6 different patients. And they sent us down there to that wing where we were going to stay. And they said, Sissy, you'll be down in this room with this lady. And Mike, you'll be up at the end of the hall in this room with this man up here. And I stopped him and I said, no. No, I don't approve of that. I said, you're putting my kids in rooms with people they don't even know, and I don't know, and I don't approve of that. And they just smiled and said, you don't have to. That's all right. And they sent Sissy this way and Mike this way. And they said, you got 30 minutes to be upstairs in this group room. And so 30 minutes later, we were in this group room upstairs. All 18 of us family members and this counselor. And I've never been able to figure this out, but he started with me. And right off the bat, we were standing up across the room shouting at each other. And you know why we were arguing? Because he asked me something about me. And I told him that was none of his business. That we weren't there about me. That we were there about her. And I'd be glad to tell him anything he needed to know about her. And I'd be glad to help him in any way I could with her. But we weren't there about me. And he looked at me and he said, Bo, you misunderstand. He said, this week is about you. He said, alcoholism is a family disease and you and these kids have been affected. And this week is about you learning how you have been affected and where you can go to get help for you. And I said, if that's what this week is about, then you lied to me in your letter. And all 18 of those people in that room got a copy of that letter. And he wrote it, but I pulled it out and I read it. And I said, if this is about me, then you lied to me in this letter. And a big old grin come on his face and he said, yeah, Bo, I lied to you. Yeah, dear. But thank God he did. Because you see, he asked me, he said, if I had sent you a letter and told you that alcoholism was a family disease and that you've been affected and that this week was about you, he said, what would you have done? And of course, I didn't have to answer him. Everybody knew. I wouldn't have been there. So thank God he lied to me and he got me there. Because you see, the next thing that happened is they started telling me my wife had a disease. That alcoholism is a disease. And that if she had a disease, I needed to learn about the 3 C's. The 3 C's being I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. Now, I knew I couldn't control it, and I knew I couldn't cure it. I had just about destroyed myself trying. What I needed to hear was, I didn't cause it. Because you know what I took up to that treatment center with me? I took that load of guilt that was just about to break my back. And what I learned up there is that my wife has a disease called alcoholism. And that way back there years ago at that party on the Warrior River, when I handed my wife that drink, I introduced her to alcohol, not alcoholism. And I am not responsible for her having that disease. And I could begin to shed that load of guilt. The next thing that happened up there is we had a lady to come up there and hold an Al-Anon meeting for us. Yeah, absolutely. And she came into that treatment center that night, and there was all 18 of us family members was there. We had to be, you know. We was mandated there. And I know that all 18 of us was there, but I'm going to tell you, I remember that meeting, and I remember it well, and I know that that lady started every sentence she said that night with Bo. she talked directly to me. But you see, she was from the old school too. And thank God she was. Because she said things to me like this. She said, "Bo, when your wife gets out of this treatment center, if she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to AA." And I kept waiting for more. And there wasn't any more. That was it. She didn't paint a picture. She didn't flyer it up. She didn't say, "They're going to encourage her to," or "It'll be nice if she does," or "We hope she does." She told me just like it was. She said, "When your wife gets out of this treatment center, if she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to AA. Period." She said, "Now, if you want to regain any of your sanity, and if you want to begin to experience any serenity, you're going to go to Al-Anon. Period. Just that simple." And then she threw the kicker in. She said, "And if you're going to be any kind of daddy at all, you're going to make sure these kids are introduced to Alateen." Yeah. And that was my introduction to this thing. Thank God I was introduced to this thing by old-timers who did not give me options. I did not need options at that time in my life. I needed direction. And that's what I got. That's what I got. We finished that family week. Shirley got out. And the very first day that she got out of treatment, we went to an AA Al-Anon anniversary in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. About 500 people at that AA Al-Anon anniversary that night. What a way to be introduced to this fellowship. And when we got back home, we did. We sat out in the middle of the living room floor with a half gallon of milk, and the kids were real worried about their mom because they knew she hadn't had a chocolate chip cookie in 38 days. And we had a big bag of chocolate chip cookies and a half gallon of milk, and we sat there, and we talked into the wee hours of the morning about something called family recovery. We talked about, did we think we could make it work? We talked about, did we want to give it a try? And we made a decision as a family that we wanted to give this thing a try. And we asked the kids to go to those four Alateen meetings, one a week, for 4 weeks. And they did. And of course, Sissy fell in love with it. She had found her place. She was just absolutely at home. Sissy fell in love with the open AA meetings. She went to Al-Anon meetings with me. And she loved her Alateen. One of the things that Shirley didn't share with you this morning that I wanted to add in about that. Sissy stayed in Alateen until she was 20, and she came into Al-Anon, and she's now been in Al-Anon for 4 years. And she's 24 years old with 11 years of recovery. Now, 2 years of her college life, she was going to college 40 miles away from home. And the last 2 years of her college life, she drove back home every Tuesday night and sponsored that Alateen group that she grew up in. Yeah. If there's an Alateen sitting in this room, or if there's an Alateen sponsor sitting in here, I want to say thank you. Thank you for raising my daughter. Thank you for giving her principles to live by. Mike went to those four meetings, and it wasn't for him, and that's okay. Mike was blonde-headed, blue-eyed. He was 15. He was dang good-looking. He had a motorcycle. He had a lot of chasing to do, and he was good at it. And I think he did some catching, too, along the way. But Mike was proud of his mom's sobriety. And Mike had his program. And he and Sissy had many closed meetings in that bedroom with that Alateen literature. He really did. And he would follow Sissy's direction. He would listen to her. He really would. And we got into this thing. Now, the first 7 months that I came, I occupied your chair. And I listened to your laughter. And I became an expert on Al-Anon. I read your books, but you see, I didn't need your program. There was nothing wrong with me. I can remember we used to have discussions on detachment, and I picked up right away that detachment's a hard thing to talk about. So I just got everything I could on detachment and became an expert on detachment so that I could give you all the right answers when we were sitting in a meeting. I had decided that this was a pretty good operation and that one day, you know, it might be okay to be president of Al-Anon. And I needed to be prepared. But you see, I wasn't working any steps and I wasn't praying. And I wasn't experiencing any kind of spiritual growth. And I didn't have a sponsor, and I wasn't doing those things. The difference is that my wife was out there in that AA room, and she was serious about her sobriety. And she had a sponsor, and she was praying, and she was working steps, and she was getting better. And I wasn't getting any better. And the gap between us was getting wider in recovery. And finally, after about 7 months of this, I came home from one of those meetings one night where there had been another big argument, and I'm sure I was the problem, the cause of the argument. And I sat down and I looked at Shirley and I said, "Shirley, you're getting so much better and I'm not getting any better." I said, "Tell me what to do." And she said, "Bo, I'll tell you what I'm doing to get better." And she said, "I got a home group and I got a sponsor and I'm working steps and I'm doing this and I'm..." And she said, "What I'd suggest you do is you go back to Bessemer tomorrow night and you get you a sponsor." So the very next night I went to Bessemer Al-Anon, and as soon as the meeting was over, I went up to this lady named Fran. And I said, "Fran, I need a sponsor. Would you be my sponsor?" And she had a temporary lapse of sanity and agreed. Now let me tell you about Fran. Fran's old enough to be my mama. And Fran's a retired school teacher. Yeah, just what I needed. And very active in Al-Anon and very active in service work. And she's a past delegate now. But Fran put a condition on it. She said, "Bo, I'm willing to sponsor you, but," she said, "you're going to have to be willing to go to work." And that was the condition. And I said, "Oh, I'm ready to go to work." Because see, going to work meant being up front. Chairing the meetings, picking the speakers, picking the topics, running the show. Yeah. And Fran knew that about me, and she said, "No, that's not what I'm talking about, honey." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "I'm talking about going to work on you." And I said, "How do I do that?" And she said, "We have 12 steps to take care of that, Bo." And she said, "If you're willing tonight to make a conscious commitment to start implementing these 12 steps in your life on a daily basis, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you." Now that's been 10 and a half years ago, and she still takes me by the hand today, and she still walks with me. Because you see, she has walked that walk. She has been there. Now, it wasn't too long into this deal that Fran and I both agreed that I was going to need a man to talk to about some things. And there were no male Al-Anons around. And my gal looked at me and she said, "Bo, there's no male Al-Anons around." She said, "But there's a room full of males over there that are working good 12-step programs." And she said, "You go get you one, because you're going to have to talk to them." Well, I just happened to pick out the one that she had been married to for 45 years. And so Jim became a part of our relationship. And that's the relationship that has been working for me. Now, Fran and Jim kind of adopted Shirley and I anyhow when we first came into that Bessemer group down there. They knew some of our family, and they were kind of interested in us, and they kind of adopted us. And for the first year and a half that Shirley and I was in the program, we thought the first step was getting the car. Because, you see, Jim and Fran didn't give us options. They gave us direction. And they would pick, the phone would ring at 4:30, and it'd be Jim, and he'd say, "We're going to Jasper tonight." Now that's 40, 45 miles away. And he didn't say, "Would you like to go?" Or, "We'd like for you to go," or, "We think it'd be good for you to go." He said, "We'll pull up in front of your house at 5:30, and when we blow the horn, get in the car." Yeah, get in the car. And it was a year and a half before we found out we could say, "We don't want to go." But that's okay. That's what we needed. And And I had this sponsor now, and I was ready to get started in this thing, and it wasn't too long before I decided I needed to do an inventory. I didn't find it necessary to tell Jim and Fran. I just thought it was time to do the inventory. And I started having problems trying to write this inventory. And so I called them one day, and I went by their house, and I walked in, and this wasn't unusual for me to call and walk and go in. And then it was kind of like when I came in the door, what's the problem this time, you know? And I walked in, and I said, you know, I said, I've been trying to do an inventory, and I'm just having all kind of trouble. And Fran looked at me, and she said, well, certainly you're having trouble. I said, where does all this wisdom come from? I said, 15 seconds ago, you didn't even know I was trying. And immediately, you know I'm having trouble. She said, Bo, if you're trying to do step four, you've got to be having trouble because you ain't through with step three. Yeah. And that's when my AA buddy, Jim, said, come on, Bo. Said, we're going to get into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the chapter to the agnostic. He said, you still got God sitting up there, and you still got God keeping score, and you still got God judging you. And he said, I don't believe that God's going to work for you. And he said, we're going to get in the chapter to the agnostic. And he said, we're going to do some work. And my buddy took me into the big book, in the chapter to the agnostic. And that's where I found the God that I have today. And it states in there about a minister's son who's having a spiritual experience. And he says he tumbled from the bed and he found himself in the presence of infinite power and love. And that he had stepped from the bridge to the shore. And he stood in conscious companionship with his Creator. Infinite power and love. That's my God today. Never-ending power, never-ending love, available to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I didn't understand the part about he had stepped from the bridge to the shore, so Jim took me back in the book and showed me where it's explained this way. Some of us have already stepped far over the bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. And you see, that's where I was getting hung up. I was hung up in reason, in understanding. I was trying to put every little peg in its proper place. And I was not accepting anything on faith. And it was when I could do that, that I was able to go on and begin to experience more spiritual growth. But you see, I had this new concept of God, but I still wasn't ready to turn it all over. I was going to turn over most of it, but not all of it. And see, this back to the Baptist church. Because see, I knew when you turned it over in the Baptist church, they did one of three things with you. They either made you a preacher, and I wasn't ready to preach, or a song director, and I couldn't sing, or they made a missionary out of you, and I didn't want to go to Africa. So I kept fighting God, and God works with me then just like he works with me today. God allows me to fight him just as long as I want to fight him, just as hard as I want to fight him, and he allows me to get just as miserable as I need to get. And I remember I got so miserable, and one Wednesday morning I got up and I looked at Shirley and I said, I don't want to go to work today. And she said, well, take a day off and stay home. And I said, I don't want to stay home. And Shirley said, what is it you want to do, Bo? And I said, Shirley, I think the best I can figure out is I want to get away from Bo. And I didn't know how to do that. And I finally decided I'd go to work because I could be as miserable there as I could anywhere and they'd pay me for it. And I started to work there in Bessemer, Alabama, and on that Wednesday morning at 8:05, I pulled my truck out of traffic on the busiest street there in Bessemer, Alabama. And I sat there on the side of that road, and I beat on the steering wheel, and I hollered at God. And I did what I know today is my version of the third step prayer. Because I hollered at God, and I said, God, I don't know where we're going, and I don't know what you're going to do with me. And I don't even know what I got that you can use. But whatever it is, God, we're fixing to do it. Because I can't fight you anymore. And if all of that fear and all of that anxiety and all of that self-pity, if all of those things could have been water, they'd have made a puddle around my feet. Because I just drained away. And I felt at ease. And I went on to work. And I never saw the burning bush. And I never saw the flash of light. And nothing spectacular happened at work that day. But I do remember that when I got home that night, I wasn't worn out, and I was comfortable, and I was okay with me. And what I've learned is that that morning, at 8:05 that Wednesday morning, when I pulled over on the side of that road, what I did was I fired Bo as general manager of Bo's Life. Yeah. And I looked around and I hired me a new general manager, and I hired the best one I could get, and it was God. And you see, that's the deal. That's my deal today. As long as I can keep Bo fired and God hired, we do all right. We do okay. It's when I start firing God and I take back control that I get in trouble. So, it was at that point that I could go on into the rest of the steps and I could begin to enjoy this journey that y'all have so graciously led me on. And let me just wind this thing down and tell you a few of the things that have come to me as a result of me making that decision that Wednesday morning and turning my will and my life over to the care of God. The first thing I'd share with you was given to me was freedom. Freedom from that guilt. Freedom from that self-pity. Freedom from that anger. Freedom from those resentments. It's not that these things don't crop back up in my life, because they do. They crop back up in the form of daily living problems. What I've been given is the freedom of choice of whether they stay or whether I get with you and we do something about them. The next thing I share with you that's been given to me is something called hope. That's our message anyhow, isn't it? Light at the end of the tunnel. It ain't as good as it's going to be, but it's a darn sight better than it was. And I think that's our message anyhow. Of course, I'd share with you that one of the things that's been given to me is this new concept of God that I shared with you. Another thing's been given to me is that you gave me back to me. Because you see, when I got here, I didn't know who I was, and I didn't know what I was. And as I hang around with you folks, I'm beginning to get a little bit of a handle on who I am and what I am. But I think even more importantly, I'm getting a handle on what I am not. And I think that's important. Because you see, there was a time I thought I had to be all things to all people. And I had to have all the answers. And I know today I don't have to have that. And I don't have to be that. But when this program gave me back to me, it made me responsible to me, for me. Now the beautiful part about that is that as long as I stay busy being responsible for me, I don't have time to try to be responsible for you. It set me free from that. Yeah. And the last thing that I'd share with you that this program's given me is by far the most important thing that this program has given me. And that is, this program has given me you. It's given me you. Because you see, I'm like that frightened child. The mom has taken the child up and they've said their prayers and she's put the child to bed. And the child is to go to sleep. And then the storm starts. And the wind's blowing and the rain's beating against the house and it's thundering and it's lightning. And the child gets scared and the child begins to cry. And the mom goes back upstairs to settle the child down. And she sits down on the bed and she's soothing the child and she's rubbing the child's hair. And she said, you know God loves you. And you know that God is going to take care of you. You know we said our prayers tonight and God's going to keep you safe. And the little child looks up and says, yeah, Mom, I know God loves me. And I know we said our prayers, and I know God's going to keep me safe. But just tonight, Mom, just tonight while the storm's going on, I need somebody with skin on them. Yeah. And you see, God knew that about me. He knew that I was going to need somebody with skin on them. Because the night did come when our lives changed. And Shirley and Sissy and I had to open that door in May of 88, May 17th. And those three policemen told us that Mike had been killed by a drunk driver. And everything that you had ever taught me and everything that I had ever read went immediately out the window. And I became very, very angry. And I became very, very bitter. And I went right back to the point that I was so many years ago. And I said, why me, God? Why me?
And I went to the phone and I called my mom. And I told her what had happened, and she said, "I'll call your brother and sister and we'll be right over." And then I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor. And Fran answered the phone and I told her what had happened. And Fran said to me, she said, "Bo, you got to hang up the phone." And I said, "No, I don't want to hang up the phone." Because you see, I had her on the other end of the phone. And she said, "No, honey, you've got to hang up the phone." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because we can't come to you as long as I'm talking to you on the phone." You see, my sponsor didn't tell me, "Pray about it and I'll see you in the morning." My sponsor didn't say, "Read page so-and-so and we'll talk tomorrow." My sponsor said, "Hang up the phone, son, where I can come to you." That's what this program's about. That's exactly what it's about. Within 30 minutes, AA and Al-Anon was in our home. And you did not leave us. You absolutely did not leave us. There was a short period of time there because of the shock that we were in that we were totally incapable of making a decision. But that's okay. You were there. And you made the decisions for us. And you made good decisions. There was an even longer period of time because of my anger at God that I was incapable of praying. And when the point came in this old boy's life that I didn't have prayer, you prayed for me. And I thank you for that. I don't know where else to get that except right here in rooms just like this, full of folks just like you. Mike was killed on Tuesday night, about 9 o'clock. Let me tell you what was going on at our house at Wednesday night at 9 o'clock. There was 15 Alateens in our front yard with a cooler full of Pepsi. And they made a circle of love. They sat down and spread eagle and put their arms around each other and made a circle of love with Sissy in the center of it. Where do you get that? You get it in rooms just like this, full of folks just like you. One more thing I want to tell you about Mike. I want to tell you about Tuesday morning, the last time I saw my son alive. As he was leaving to go to work at 7 o'clock that morning, he walked by my chair where I was with my cup of coffee. And he stopped and he patted me on the shoulder. And he said, "I'm going to work, Dad." And he took about 3 steps toward the front door. And he turned around. And he said, "I love you, Dad." And out the door he went. The last words that I ever heard my son speak were, "I love you, Dad." And you gave me that. You taught us how to live that way. We didn't know how to live that way till we found you. And you taught us how to live that way. What's so ironic is that that was not a strange deal. We did that every day. We did that every day. Just how powerful is this way of life? I don't know. My simple mind is not capable of comprehending the power of this way of life. I share this with you. There's a real live alcoholic sitting back there that you heard talk this morning. And I saw her walk through the pain of losing her son that way. And she did not have to take a drink. And I suggest to you that that is powerful. That is powerful. There's a real live Al-Anon standing here in front of you tonight that did not have to load the shotgun and go do something totally insane to a drunk driver. And I suggest to you that that is powerful. And it all came from you. It all came from you. So I hope that if you don't understand anything else about Bo tonight, that you understand just how important you are to me. You see, I have to have you. You are my link. You are my survival.
So now that you understand just how important you are to me, I want to close by making a deal with you. And here's the deal. I'm going to keep coming back to rooms just like this, full of folks just like you. And I want you to keep coming back. And if I keep coming back, and you keep coming back, then I'm sure that one day our paths will cross again as we trudge this road to a happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.